change is gonna come.
See that you actually are a leader.
I was with Nike for a very long time and built my career in retail.
You know, I think this podcast just got its first exclusive.
Being an entrepreneur is hard. The highs are really high and then the lows are really low.
That I'm actually really interested in hearing more about.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like transitioning verticals?
Being open to opportunity.
I feel like, okay, like if not now, then when?
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Motivated Podcast. We feature thought leaders and industry experts, and we talk about what they're working on, some of the strategies that they are working on, how they've deployed it during this time, and also how do they shift their mindset and keep people around them motivated. And my name is Dahlia Strum. I teach marketing at the Fashion Institute of Technology here in New York, and I also run an agency called Rethink Connect, where we storytell through experiential moments. And I am here with my amazing podcast co-host, Pablo. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Pablo Henderson. Other than being Dahlia's co-host, I'm also the chief marketing officer at Xwell, and thrilled to be welcoming Marcus Collins to the Motivated Podcast. Marcus is an award-winning marketer and cultural translator. He's chief strategy officer at Wieden Kennedy New York, where he is sitting today out of New York to talk to us, and a marketing professor at the Ross School of Business. Marcus, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm stoked to be here.
We're beyond excited to have you, Marcus. And we have actually spent a lot of time reading your book. So we are super excited not only to have this conversation, but to hear some of your thoughts. I think more specifically, like understanding motivation around user behavior. As I'm talking about that, I realize that user behavior is more of a marketing term. So let's simplify it. I think your premise is more that you feel strongly that we can motivate people to take certain actions. And I'd love to hear your thoughts around that.
Yeah, I would say as a marketer, the core function of our job is to influence behavior, full stop. Don't drink this, drink that. Don't go here, go there. Don't buy his shoes, buy my shoes. Don't vote for her, vote for him. Everything we do as marketers, our job is to get people to move. Oddly enough, even if you don't have marketer in your title, we're all trying to get people to move. We're trying to get people to vote a certain way, get people to wear a mask, get people to follow the policy in an organization. I try to get my kids to eat peas. Like, we're constantly trying to influence behavior. And the notion becomes, well, what gets people to move? There's motivation, for sure. Are there other parts to the calculus that drives motivation? Are there antecedents to motivations that get people to move? And what ultimately influences the actions that we take on? Whether you have marketer in your title or not, we are all constantly trying to make that happen. Whether you're a leader doing it with your team or you're an employee trying to get seen, we're always trying to motivate people to move. And I argue in the book that there's no force more influential to human behavior than culture. No external force, that is, more influential to human behavior than culture. And if we understand the sway of culture, then we can harness its power to get people to move.
I think Marcus has been reading either a lot of Dr. Seuss or he's working on a rap because he's starting to rhyme.
I'm a poet. I didn't even know it.
Can culture be individualistic, or does it need the validation of a community and folks to subscribe to that culture for it to be a thing?
Yeah, I think culture is an operating system, and for a system to bear itself out, you need more people who abide by it. And you think about this in a social group. Like, say you're in your family and you feel like the black sheep of the family. Like, man, I tend to do my own thing. I don't do it like what is normal. I sit on the outsides of it. Well, what happens when you are the black sheep? You go find other black sheeps. And collectively, you become a community of black sheeps. And in that community of black sheeps, there is a norm. There are social norms that people like us do, conventions and expectations that govern what it means to be one of us. And even within that population of black sheeps, there's someone who's like a real black sheep. He's like the black sheep of the black sheeps. And that black sheep of the black sheep goes find other black sheeps of the black sheeps, and they build their own community. And what happens is that in each one of these social groups, there are conventions and expectations that govern what it means to be a part of these groups. Right? They demarcate who we are and what's acceptable for people like us. And that, by definition, is culture, the governing operating system of humanity. What people like us do around here because of how we see the world and what's expected of people who abide by the same cultural subscription that we do.
Pablo, you were nodding real hard. Are you the black sheep in your family?
There's an amazing piece of poetry about black sheep. I'll have to pull up the author while we're chatting, around the importance of black sheep in family trees and changing ancestral trauma. And that is the importance of the black sheep in each family is to actually breed new branches of that tree, new opportunities, new ways of thinking and doing that then create those new branches of the tree, much like what you just described, Marcus, but in a context of generational culture as opposed to pop culture. One of the reasons I was nodding is because I was agreeing with everything you were saying, but I was also wondering.
And also, you're the black sheep.
what the difference between norms and culture is.
Yeah. So norms are a part of culture. So I look at culture through a Durkheimian lens. Emile Durkheim, one of the founding fathers of sociology. Sociology is where most of my literature sits. My repertoire of literature sits in sociology. So I tend to look to those early founding fathers pretty frequently. And Durkheim refers to culture as a system of beliefs, norms, and symbols that demarcate who we are and what people like us do. The conventions and expectations. Then a little over a century later, a gentleman by the name of Raymond Williams, who's a cultural scholar, says that really it's a system of systems, that it starts with our identity. Like, it's anchored, culture is anchored in our identity. Who am I? And because of who I am, I see the world a certain way. I have a set of beliefs and ideologies that frame the world. And because of how I see the world, I show up in the world a certain way. My identity manifests a certain way, i.e., what I wear, my artifacts, symbols, patterns, signs, my behaviors. These are norms, traditions, ceremony, right? The unwritten rules of what people like us do, and the language that we use. Then we express it through some cultural production, i.e. literature, music, film, toys, symbols, tools, and brands and branded products. So the question of, are norms culture? Well, norms are a component of culture. It's a way by which our cultural subscription is manifested through our behaviors, through the normal things that people like us do. If I extend my hand to out to you like this, you'd probably do the exact same thing and we'll collapse hands because that's what's normal for people like us. If you're in Paris, you do air kisses because that's normal for people like us. In Paris, if you're Parisian, right? So the idea here is that culture is a far more encompassing system of things, and norms are just one system that makes up what we would call culture.
What if you were going to say you identify with specific cultures, what would they be? And would they be, and the reason I'm asking is, would they be led by brands that you identify with, or would they be led by what we would consider traditional cultures, like ethnic culture?
No, they would be specifically led by like segments of the market. Like, I resonate with entrepreneurship. So like, I can geek out 4 hours with another entrepreneur. It doesn't even matter if I know anything about the topic. I know bits and pieces around it. I can identify with fashion, right? It doesn't have to be a specific brand. It's any segment within fashion. I'm interested in all of it because I teach at the Fashion Institute of Technology. So I've taken a stronger interest there. Marketing, right? Like, we're all in different areas of marketing, but I'm fascinated with the segments as a whole because that's where I can have the more powerful conversations, I think.
You know, the literature talks about identity. To your point, Dahlia, literature talks about identity in multiple ways. There are individual references, right? Like, I'm a professor at the Ross School of Business, University of Michigan. So because I identify as a professor, I see the world a certain way, right? As one would who considers himself a professor, right? But even that's not monolithic. There's social references. I'm in a fraternity called Phi Beta Sigma. So like, my identity is anchored in that. So I see the world a certain way. There are abstract references. I'm a father of two girls, Georgia and Ivy. But what does it mean to be a father? Well, it depends on how you see the world, right? There are consumption references, right? Like Dahlia says, like, I'm into fashion. That is a consumption reference, right? We refer to that as a culture of consumption. Because of my consumption identity, I align to what the expectations of people like me are. I'm a sneakerhead. I'm not. But if one said I'm a sneakerhead, then the way you wear your sneakers, how you treat your sneakers, how you dress from the feet up, like those things are all expectations of people who are sneakerheads. But there also are people who are diehard Game of Thrones fans. That is an identity they subscribe to. That is a brand. They're Swifties. There's the Beehive, there's Hogs, there's Trekkies. Like these are consumption related, but they're tied specifically to a brand. So when we think about identity, Pablo, I love the other question that you asked there, is that we hold many identities and they have different kind of references. However, the way that they propagate out into how we manifest that identity still abides by the same systems, which is pretty fantastic.
So a couple of things. First, I want to acknowledge that we're all wearing black. And I just find that to be interesting as we're talking about culture.
This is New York. This is what you do.
Yeah, this is what I classify as a uniform. But you know what? It's funny that you say that, Marcus. So you're in New York, you wear black. Do you find that when you go elsewhere, you wear other colors?
So the interesting part. So I used to live in New York for about 8 years and I developed a uniform.
We have the uniform.
So even though I live in Ann Arbor now, I wear the uniform. It's either black with white or I wear blue with powder blue. Like it's just what I do.
But is it because it's location specific? So when you go back to Ann Arbor.
I get what you're getting at. So here's the interesting part. When I come to New York, I typically wear a Detroit Tigers hat. Why? Because I want people from Detroit to be like, oh, you're from the D. What up? Right? What up, though? Is specifically what we say it. But when I'm in Detroit, I hardly ever wear a Detroit Tigers hat. Why? Because everyone wears a Detroit Tigers hat. Instead, I wear a U of M hat. So then people will see me, they go blue. And I go, yeah, go blue. And this is like the fascinating part to me about culture, particularly consumption culture, is that we consume not because of what these things are, it's because of who we are. And we use brands and branded products as a way of signaling our identity. So that when we don them, it makes our culture material. One, two, people can go blue. And I go blue. Immediately, I feel connected. And as social animals, that's all we want is connection.
I was going to say that felt more like it was a story about how you were signaling than anything else.
Right.
Because aside from those responses that you're trying to evoke, you are actually communicating a lot as a man of color, as a person who is in a geographic setting. You're communicating not just the response that you're trying to evoke, but all of the status that comes with each one of those. There's more cred in New York to wearing that Detroit cap and having some hipster vibes. And there's more cred in being in Michigan and being affiliated with a school, especially a prestigious school, that signals. I was going to go back to graduate school, so excited to tell my eldest son about it. And I was like, yeah, you know, I've submitted for this program and I've been accepted and I'm going to be going. And he was like, oh, tell me about the program. I told him about the program. And he's like, you're just signaling. And I was like, gosh, that was not the response I was expecting. And I had to go back and really think about whether my motives behind pursuing all of that. And I do think that signaling influences motives far greater than we tend to admit.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I mean, and can you describe signaling to people for the layperson who may not understand that term, but I think it's pretty obvious. But
absolutely. Well, so signaling is a way by which we implicitly denote who we are and where we sit in the social hierarchy. And this is actually quite interesting. It's a fun fact for you. For centuries, the global GDP was zero. Zero. That means like there was hardly any exchange, any commerce happening for centuries until 16th century Queen Elizabeth. And she had the brilliant notion that she was going to use consumption as a means of aggrandizement, as a means of power. And the idea was this: royalty would have almost everything. Nobility will have a little less. The peasants will have nothing. And the idea is that nobility will keep consuming so they can maintain their social status next to, adjacent to royalty. And the peasants will always look up with admiration, wanting more and more. And so was the case for a century. 18th century, beginning 18th century, you see a little spark in commerce happening, economic spark happening in Northern Europe. And companies start to make a little money. So they started to pay their employees more. And what did employees go do? They went to go spend more money, right? To signal who they are and where they are in the social hierarchy. And as a result, companies made more money. So they played and spend They pay employees more, so they spend more money. So I get this cycle of consumption. Industrial Revolution happens at the end of the 18th century. Kaboom. More things are being made. People are making more money. More things are being spent. More. So what's the point? That from its very conception, consumption had very little to do with the functionality of things and everything to do with the psychological and sociological impulses that drive us to move, that motivate us to move. So when we are consuming, from its very nature, from the very beginning, had nothing to do with the razor sharper, the battery lasts longer, the car goes faster. It provides some value for me that's functional. Instead, it signals who I am and where I sit across inside the social hierarchy. So when I consume, it is a cultural act. It's a way of signaling who I am and what people like us do. Not only from what we wear to how we adorn ourselves, if you have hair. That's one thing we all don't have in common right here, Dahlia. You got hair, what you drive, the kind of products you use, the kind of phone you use, where do you go to school, if you go to school, clearly Pablo, where you, who you marry, if you get married, what you eat, how you vacation, where you bury the dead, if you bury the dead. All of these things that we take on that we think are outside of us are actually social forces pushing us to be normal in an effort to signal where we are in the world. And that's a really powerful thing.
You know, it's funny because you mentioned Swifties before, and I was thinking about everything, the craziness that has been happening recently with these tickets, going upwards for $5,000, $8,000 a ticket. And I know that in the very beginning when they were released, there was demand, but it's almost like the higher, the more frequently people discuss it, the more frequently they discuss it within their social circles, the demand then increases. And I'd be curious about your thoughts on what's signaling there. Is it a status thing? If you have these tickets, you are thereby considered cool? Or is it decreased inventory increases the demand? What is like the real psychological behavior happening there?
Yeah, nothing draws a crowd like a crowd. If everyone's doing it, I ought to be doing it too. There's a psychologist named George Lowenstein from Carnegie Mellon. He talks about this as the gap in knowledge. He says when there's a gap in knowledge, it creates cognitive deprivation. And we allocate all of our mental energy to close the gap. And because other people are doing it, we feel like it must be of value. And we've always been this way, right? Relying on social learning helps us maintain some of our cognitive power without having to know everything we learn from other people. And if everyone's talking about this concert and everyone's going, it's the place to be, even if you aren't a Swiftie. Because if you get a ticket, you go, wow, I'm not even a Swiftie, but I'm going. Wow, look at me. Like that gives you a dopamine hit. There is a functional, there's a social need and an emotional need that gets done, a job that gets completed. And as a result, we are more motivated to want it.
What about when a culture evolves from an organic need? I'm gonna focus on hip hop culture here. It starts off as one thing and evolves into another and then morphs into something that one would argue maybe no longer serves its need.
Sure, sure.
I've made the controversial statement in the past around, is hip hop culture good?
Mm.
And I'm not a popular guy in a lot of circles. I'm a former nightclub owner, and I used to have some of the hottest hip hop nights. I've had every major hip hop DJ, producer, artist, you name it, across the spectrum. Yeah. And within that community of people, I am seen as a sellout, as, you know, an Uncle Tom. I mean, you know, I shouldn't even utter those words out of my mouth. And I can use the fact that I'm English to get away with a lot of things, but criticizing hip hop culture is not one of them that I'm given a pass on.
That's tough. That's a tough one.
But I'm not roping you into something controversial here.
No, but I have one better for you. Marcus isn't even a sneakerhead and he's talking about culture. I mean, what are we talking with here?
But I would like to use hip hop as an example. Yep. Like it starts off with all these very specific needs. And then at some point, and maybe it's because I turn on the radio and there's nothing I can hear to this day that I can relate to anymore, is no longer serving the same needs. And yet that culture evolves again onto something else that still keeps the same core value or meaning, even though that value is not being provided to anybody.
Sure. I mean, there's so much to unpack there because first of all, it is a controversial statement, but there's so much to unpack there. And I think it's because it's full of richness. At its core, culture always changes, always. Like the way Christianity is practiced today is different than it was when Jesus was with his disciples. Like, it changes. Is it good or bad? It depends on how you see things, right? It depends on how you see things. You know, when MC Hammer started doing Pepsi commercials and Kentucky Fried Chicken commercials, everyone said he was a sellout, right? Now, you ain't big if you got an endorsement deal, right? It is relished if you have an endorsement deal. Well, what's happening here? The conventions and expectations of the community has evolved. And how does it evolve? It evolves through our discourse, through the conversations that we have, whether we decide people like us do something like this, which is why, you know, we'll hear quote unquote mumble rap today and be like, these guys ain't saying nothing. Where I'm sure that's what our parents thought. I know that's what my parents thought when I first started listening to hip hop. They're like, this isn't even music. I mean, think about that. When hip hop first came on the scene, people said, this isn't even music. Why? Because you're borrowing someone else's music. You're just talking. That's not even musical. But now hip hop is the number one genre consumed in the country. Things change. People's perspective changes. Meaning changes. And culture is a meaning-making system. So why do these things change? And what makes things the pure version of itself? Well, there is no gatekeeper of what a culture is. It is what the collective believes it is reflective of. So is hip hop culture bad? I think that's an objective statement. I don't think that's a fair estimate. But there are parts of the culture that I think aren't great. For instance, you know, I grew up in a hip hop culture where women were objectified. I grew up in a hip hop culture where if you showed any ounce of emotion, you were soft, right? Or worse, not even worse, or more so, you were gay if you showed any emotion, right? But then you have someone like Kanye West, the old Kanye, and Drake and Kid Cudi that show a more emotional side of who they are. And as a result, we have that a part of the hip hop cultural expression, and people find themselves, they see themselves in it. I mean, and this is the power of cultural production. Hip hop is a form of cultural production, right? Hip hop music, rather, rap music is a form of cultural production, that the storytelling and folklore that's in the music become ways by which people express who they are, but also reflect who they are. Are there aspects that aren't great? Sure. I mean, I love Native Tongue, Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, like, that's where my heart was. But I listened to 2 Live Crew as well. These guys probably weren't the best decorum of what it means to be an upright citizen. So that's a long way and maybe an unfocused way of saying, I don't know if that is a fair statement. There are parts of the culture, the beliefs, the artifacts, behaviors, and language of hip hop that I think leaves a lot to be desired. But if I look at where it came from, there've been a lot of upgrades too.
But I want to go back to this concept of motivating people to take action, because like right now, the concept of influencers, influencer marketing, it's become such a buzzword that people don't value the concept anymore. So if we go back to its roots, to its core, how do you motivate people to take action? Like, I'm going to geek out for a quick second. We look at the marketing funnel and like every component of the marketing funnel, and there
she just couldn't resist. She had to get some type of marketing piece in there. Okay, we're going to give her this one. We'll let her have it. Go ahead, Dahlia.
All right, hold on. I'll rephrase it.
There's no getting out of it. You're there. It's not good. You're there. There's no getting out of it.
I think that the problem is on a daily basis, I talk to people and their bigger question is, how do I generate sales? Instead of understanding that marketing is part of generating sales. And it goes back to basics, motivating people to take an action. And I'd love to hear your thoughts just like from the basics. Let's say you had a startup. What are some like quick insights that you would give somebody to say, this is what you need to do to motivate people?
Yeah, I first say, well, what do you want people to do? Like that's like if marketing... So marketing by definition is going to market. 1455 definition, old English dictionary says marketing is going to market, the act of going to market, not the marketplace, but the market. And who makes up the market? We do.
The people make up the marketplace.
Exactly. So marketing is going to the people. Well, with what do we go to the people? A product. Ooh, a product better product services somewhere in between. Great, right? And then do we just give to people for free? Well, sometimes, or other times, there's a price. And that price is often money. Sometimes it's your data. Sometimes it's your information. Sometimes it's your attention. Sometimes it's your social capital, right? So we go to market with a product that we assign a price, some rate of exchange. We do it through what Jerome McCarthy called a place. We probably call it a pipeline, right? Some distribution to get it to people.
By the way, quick edit, we might not give products away for free, right? Or anything away for free.
Well, I say nothing is for free, right? Like there's some exchange. Like if it's not money, it may be your time, your data, your attention, your social capital, something. There's an exchange rate, right? And then we get it to people through some pipeline or place that Jerome McCarthy called it. And then we communicate through marketing promotions. And the four P's, Jerome McCarthy gave it to us. These are the levers that we pull by which we go to market. There have been some additional P's after that, but those are the four kind of core P's. And the notion is that we pull the levers of the four P's to get people to move. Well, what do we want people to do? And oftentimes we say, I want people to buy my product. Great. But if no one's ever heard of your product, are they going to buy it right away? No. What do they need to do first? Maybe they need to go to the website. Awesome. Design these catalysts that get people to go to the website. Sweet. Maybe it's a car and you're like, oh man, the lead time to buy a car is a lot. You need to go to the website, maybe build my thing, see a lot of ads, like all these different complexities are part of the calculus that gets people to move. So we need to know what we want people to do, identify the behavior, and then ultimately what gets people to move. What is the thing that is the most influential force on human behavior? Well, that starts with a C and ends with an ultra. It's called culture.
So I agree with you. I do think that culture gets people to move. And marketing is about getting people to move, right? But when we speak about motivation, where we get stuck sometimes is that a lot of folks are like, yep, motivation is one thing, but it comes and goes. What about consistency, right? Yeah. And I think culture, used effectively, can get you to move and then affiliate and then keep moving to some extent.
That's right.
But when it comes to forming habits, when it comes to changing behavior that is not tied to consumption,
yep.
Do you still believe that culture is the strongest form of motivator?
1000%, because I would say culture becomes the antecedent to building the habit, right? Like, one may say, like, I get coffee in the morning. Well, the functional need to be done, sure. But then there's a social and emotional job to be done as well that I satiate by going to Starbucks as opposed to going to Dunkin' Donuts. And the habit becomes, I go to Starbucks. Why? Because people like me do something like this. That is the driving question of culture. Do people like me do something like this? The answer is yes, I do it. The answer is no, I don't. If you look at the literature of motivation, it gets like actually quite interesting. So what the literature tells us is that we start off with an unmet need, right? There's a need that I have, to your point, Pablo, there's a need that I have. And the idea is that that need creates a discomfort for us, right? Maybe it's, I have a need to eat, my stomach is groggling, I'm hungry, now I am motivated to go get some food, right? I have an unmet need to be socially included, right? I feel isolated, so now I am sufficiently motivated to take on an action that will make me a part of the community. Well, what informs the actions that we're willing to take? Our attitudes, our perspectives, what we learn, our disposition, what we believe, how we see the world. These are all aspects of culture. So while we're motivated because there is some anemia in need, what actually dictates what we do abides by our cultural subscription. And as a result, the options available to me informs the behaviors that I take on. For instance, if I say, I'm hungry, I have a need to eat. My stomach is groggling. I'm uncomfortable. I am sufficiently motivated to get some food. But if I'm a vegan, I'm not going to Five Guys. That's not even an option for me. I now look at the consideration set of what people like me do. And therefore, my behaviors, my actions are mediated by the cultural norms, the conventions of people like me. And as a result, I move.
You know, it's funny because you're saying it like it's such a simplistic approach. But when you worked on the Nets campaign, a lot of thought went into how do you motivate people?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was a very creative approach because you had tiers of elements of motivation. And as we're talking about this, look, I think it's easy to say, yes, when you are hungry, you are motivated to go eat, but you'll be motivated to go eat. If you're a vegan at a vegan restaurant, you'll be motivated to go grab a coffee from Starbucks because this aligns with what we classify as culture. But your thought process around the Nets campaign was a little bit more in depth. And it's really like, it's funny because I am actually going against my own grain when I am saying, let's not geek out about marketing. So I'm really trying to keep this mindful around motivation and how do we motivate people to take action?
Yeah.
And it wasn't such a simplistic thought process. And I think that I have to remember on my own, the actions that we are asking people to take aren't always simplistic. And there's a lot of thought that goes into it.
Absolutely. I state it plainly because the mechanisms at play are plain. And maybe it's the engineer in me. I studied engineering undergrad, so I'm always looking at the systems of things. And the mechanisms, the components that make up the system are plain. They are what they are. Now, our ability to understand them and leverage them, that's where it gets difficult. So Dahlia, let's talk about the Brooklyn Nets. So the company I worked for at the time, we got a brief for this new team that's moving from New Jersey to Brooklyn. That's super cool because how often do you get an NBA team that's moving from one location to another? However, the New Jersey Nets was not a great team. They never won a championship. They think it made it to the finals once and got swept. No good. Also, anyone who's listened to this probably knows this. If you live in New York doesn't really like a lot of exports from Jersey. Like maybe they'll do like Bon Jovi and like Bruce Springsteen. Maybe Lauryn Hill. Everything else, not happening, right? So New Yorkers, by very nature, sort of repel anything coming from New Jersey. So you got a bad team, the people who don't want this team. And not only that, we were building an arena in the middle of Atlantic Terminal, which we're going to displace small businesses and residents. Not good. I mean, people were protesting about this team coming. And the brief we got from the client was to make the Brooklyn Nets to Brooklyn, what the Knicks are to Manhattan. That's a tough, tough feat. So,
it's because you're asking to change user behavior. And I think
exactly
that, like, you're asking people to be motivated to think differently. And that I think was the biggest challenge.
So that's what marketing is, right? We go to market to get people to move. Oftentimes, to change their behavior, either eat burgers, we don't eat burgers, or eat three burgers a month instead of two burgers, right? We're constantly trying to get people to move. So considering the value propositions were so terrible for the team and what we were dealing with, ask ourselves, like, well, what do we know about the people? People are trying to move. What do we know about the cultural expectations of people like them, i.e. people who describe themselves or self-define themselves as Brooklynites? Brooklynites are very proud of themselves, extremely proud of themselves, right? That phrase, is Brooklyn in the house? Like, that's a real thing. These guys, you can't tell no Brooklynite nothing. And we said, whoa, what if we pull a page from Edward Bernays' propaganda theory? Edward Bernays, one of the founding fathers of propaganda, he says that you can unite a people by declaring an enemy of the state. And he's like, that's awesome because there is an inherent enemy to Brooklyn, and it's called Manhattan. Like, Brooklynites know this. I was living in Brooklyn at the time too, so I am experiencing it daily. I had to schlep into the city every morning, back home to Brooklyn. There was an inherent tension, so much so that on the weekends, do not invite me to the city because I ain't going. I'll see you in Brooklyn or I'll see you Monday morning, right? There's tension that already exists. And we use that tension to create a rivalry such that people will support the Brooklyn Nets, not because of what the team is, but because of who they are. That is, they will buy Brooklyn Nets gear. They'll go to the games. They'll support the team as a receipt of their identity. Or as Pablo mentioned earlier, to signal who they are, right? People were motivated to move, not because of the value propositions of the product, which weren't great at the time. We didn't even know who the team was going to be, by the way. But we did it based upon their cultural subscription and what people like them do. And as a result, more Brooklynites started repping Brooklyn gear because more Brooklynites started repping Brooklyn gear. Nothing draws a crowd like a crowd.
Yeah, but it was the strategy. That's what I'm the most impressed with. And I think that you're the most proud of the execution. I think your thought process around the strategy to motivate people to take action, because it wasn't such a simplistic, okay, Nets are coming to Brooklyn. It wasn't done that way. It was actually done in layers, where you started out like with those billboards. There was no branding on it whatsoever. And I'd be curious how you thought about the execution of it.
I mean, this is the interesting part. And I agree with you. Actually, I get more excited about cracking the code more so than the tactical part of it. Right? Maybe it's the strategist in me. You know, there's this this great example of leadership, a gentleman by the name of, I think it's Ernest Shackleton. And he has this amazing classified ad that he put in the newspaper like back in the early 1900s, I believe. And he said, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but essentially was looking for men to sail out to sea. Death is highly likely. Injury likely is going to happen, but glory and honor is a definite. That was the ad. And people were like, oh, sign me up for that. Why? Because they were sufficiently motivated by that. Why? Because their ethos, their belief and ideology is that that's what people like them do. And therefore, they risk their lives for the thing that matters to them. Just like we spend our money for things that matter to us. And does it matter to everyone? No. Like, I'm not a sneakerhead. I wouldn't spend $15,000 on a pair of sneakers. But I got friends who are like, oh man, that's light work, B. Are you kidding me? Like, it's light work. Because of how they see the world. And yeah, that's the important part when we think about motivating people, is that the world is not objective, it's subjective, right? Things aren't the way they are the way that we are, right? And the way we are is based on our cultural subscription. That's why for some, a cow is leather, for others, it's a deity, and for some, it's dinner. But which one is it? It's all of them, based on how you see the world. So we're trying to motivate people. It's not like, well, I'm going to get these people to do this because that's what I would do. No. It's about understanding how they see the world and leverage what we know about human behavior, the underlying physics that govern each and every one of us, and use those things, leverage those things to get people to move.
This isn't an indictment on racial identity, socioeconomic identity, gender identity, political identity, or anything else. But I do find it interesting that our basic thought pattern around culture is this idea of people like me. Yet we're constantly in a battle to not be perceived as people like me.
Right.
And that conflict that coexists on a constant basis, where we are trying to take ownership of what is expected of people like me by branding it, you know, by expressing it through commerce,
yeah,
is acceptable as long as we are the ones that are controlling that message. But we refuse, or we rebut it happening to us when it is outside of our control.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Because I find it fascinating that that we are spending much of our time overthinking this idea of people like me. Well, this is what I should, you know, I drive a Volvo, Dahlia drives a Tesla, right? And we very much, people like me drive, you know, I live in Connecticut, I drive my Volvo, and she's very much, oh, you know, I'm not going to fill in all the blanks on Dahlia, because that might end our friendship on this podcast live, but people like her drive a Tesla. And yet,
my easy response could be, what does that mean? People like me drive a Tesla.
So I don't know. I'm curious to get your thoughts on that, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one controversial statement that I agree with you on. And I think that the question becomes, well, who are people like me? And there are labels that we put on people that they don't use to self-identify, right? We'll say, you know, gender, men do this. Really? Like, what is it about them? Like, I don't look in the mirror and say, I'm a man. No, like, I don't self-identify by that label, right? I say, I'm a Christian. I'm a Collins. I'm a Michigan Wolverine. Like, these are the labels that I affix to myself as a way of signaling who I am in the world. As marketers, like, we are terrible at this. We put people in boxes, not because it's real, but because it's easy, right? Not because it's accurate, but because it's fluid, right? It's this cognitive fluidity when you come to these things. Talk about this in the book too. You know, meet my friend Deborah. Deborah drives a minivan. Does Deborah have kids? Probably. Do her kids play a sport? Yeah. What sport? Soccer. Yeah. And where does Deborah live? In Connecticut with Pablo, right? In the suburbs somewhere, right? And like, we, one data point, we map out Deborah's entire life, not because it's accurate, but because of the box that we put minivan drivers in who are women. And we do this all the time. We go, oh, Black people do this. Hispanic people do that. No, they don't. Because we are not a monolith. Not only we're not a monolith, but people don't look in the mirror and say, this is my identity, right? I don't look in the mirror and say, I'm a Gen Xer, you know, I love Netflix and I hang out with my friends. This is ridiculous. Like, we don't self-identify that. And because we don't self-identify by that, there aren't beliefs and ideologies that are associated to us. So while we're like people like me, one thing about people like me, I think about people who see the world the way I do, who believe what I believe, and therefore manifest their beliefs accordingly, right? Or maybe think people who've experienced life the way I have. And when we use race, it's a shortcut for that, right? Because there's people who are Black who experience a completely different way of life than I have. And I go, oh man, like, we don't jive, my G. Like, we don't jive. But Pablo, as you say, like, I worked in the music industry. Like, I worked in the music industry too. I imagine we could talk for hours about that. And like, you become like me. We're all marketers. We lock in on that. And that's a part of our identity, right? So when we talk about identity, it's not about how we describe people. It's about how they self-identify. And that requires great proximity, which most of the time we don't have.
Here's the good news, Pablo. You're not driving a minivan, so you're breaking the mold from Connecticut.
You know, I wanted to ask a question that I don't think is covered in the book. And this is around how an individual can leverage culture to motivate themselves.
Oh, yeah.
So a tangible, like, how do I... Okay, I get it. I see this. This is great for brands. This is great for marketers, great for entrepreneurs. But I want to find a hack, a cheat. You talk about, you use the term cheat code, but what's the cheat code for the individual to move, to get movement going?
It's cultural, the consumption of cultural product and affirmations. So think of it this way. If you got a big presentation, you listen to music that gets you amped up. Basketball players, listen to music that gets you amped up. Like, it's telling me you got this, fam. You about to go. You're listening to that, telling yourself that this is what I'm going to do. And as a result, we do it. People who are deeply religious, they listen to gospel music. Why? Because what they're continuing to receive in repetition is communicating what people like them do. The same thing goes with us as individuals. Right? Like, the things that we ingest, they become like mini pep squads in our head telling us to do this. And when we look in the mirror and say, yo, Marcus, you got this. I'm telling myself I got this. Why? Because this is what people like me do. You're a winner. Like, you're here for a reason. Why do I believe that? Because I believe God put me here. My faith is expressing that to me. Right? So we use the affirmation that we tell ourselves and the stories that we ingest and the cultural product that we take on to get a sense of what people like us ought to do. Like, we are motivating ourselves based upon consumption and self-talk.
This is like the concept of the quiet internet. Have you heard this term?
No, but I'm intrigued.
The quiet internet is using the content that you consume on the internet to create the algorithm in your favor towards only positive outcomes. You're basically anything that you would view that is remotely negative or doesn't support your purpose or your mission or your personal brand, you delete it, you block it, you shut it off. Eventually, right. The algorithm is tricked into only serving up things that are part of your your desired curated identity in some way.
What is it, like TikTok on steroids?
Well, it doesn't take a lot. It means that you have to have a little bit of self-discipline not to watch junk videos and junk reels, and a little bit of discipline to continue to pursue things that are somewhat intellectual, spiritual, well-being focused. And then it'll become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But it's by quieting the negative side of the internet that you're able to get to that point. And more people are starting to take ownership of that. And because everything is machine learning, it works both ways, right? You can get the machine learning to work in your favor. I've done it personally around this idea of well-being, but it's becoming more and more of a phenomena.
I love that so much. That kind of got me jazzed up right now, because I wrote the book from a pragmatic perspective for practitioners, whether you're marketing your title, leader, entrepreneur, manager, activist, politician, clergy, etc. But when I was writing the book, I realized something else. I realized that the early decisions I made as a young adult, they weren't made by me. They were made for me. right? Like I was from Detroit, studied math. I did well in math and science. So when I graduated from high school, I was an engineer. I studied engineering because that's what people like me were supposed to do. The cultural expectations of people like me is that you did well in math and science, you become an engineer. I didn't really want to be one, but I did it because I was supposed to do. I remember coming home after my first year of college, said, Mom and Dad, I don't think I want to do this. My mother's an academic. My father is just like, you know, just go after it. And you're like, wait till you get to your major, you'll love it. So I go back to my major. At second year, I really didn't love it. And I ended up taking some music theory courses to offset my terrible GPA. And I got back home after the summer, second year, I said, you know what, Mom, Dad, I think I want to be a songwriter. They go, oh, no, you don't. That is not true. And I ended up finishing my engineering degree, even though I suffered through it. And what I realized is that I never knew how to articulate what was happening to me because I didn't have the language, the Rosetta Stone. But what was happening is that there were cultural forces telling me to do a particular thing. Not only that, from a metacognitive perspective, there are cultural forces telling my parents to do a particular thing. That even though your son is suffering, good parents will force their kids, push their kids to do things that are going to lead to a better outcome. That's just what good parenting is, at least in their minds. Right. And because we didn't have the right language, the Rosetta Stone, to discuss it, I didn't have very much agency. So when you think about this idea of the quiet internet, it's taking agency to curate what's around you, who's around you. So from personal perspective, if you're at a company and you go, man, like I like the work that I do, but I just don't feel right here. Well, why is that? Maybe it's because you don't adhere to the beliefs. Or maybe the company isn't manifesting its beliefs in its behaviors, in its language. It's providing the reader lexicon to actually identify the components that make up culture and say, this is the problem. I can either try to fix it or I go somewhere else where I feel like I belong. And that's a really powerful thing, agency. And the hope is that not only does it provide, you know, some intellectual curiosity and even provide some tools for practitioners, that it helps us all adopt some agency and able to navigate the world in which we live, even if it means tricking the algorithm so that I am ingested with the content that is reflective of who I want to be. The cultural production is a reflection of who I want to be, not because of where I am only.
You know, you both brought up this concept of repetition. So Marcus, you said it before, if you do it on repeat, and Pablo, the quiet internet essentially is repopulating content that aligns with who you are, which is essentially repetition, right? Like we're repeating this in process. And I think that it's interesting because we forget about the value just in general of motivating people through repetition. If you hear something over and over again, A, it generates interest. B, it could generate a conversion. I think about my user behavior and the things that I've actually purchased on social media. This is embarrassing. It happens because eventually you see that ad so many times that it piques your interest. You start to do some research. If you only see it once or twice, there's no actual interest that's generated, or maybe nominal interest. It's the repetition that really creates that momentum.
But that's why culture can't be an event. Like culture can't be a day, right? Culture has to be what happens consistently because you need to create norms, something that's normative behavior that you can expect. So there's an element of expectation within the culture. If suddenly something that read a certain way suddenly read completely different, it would really throw off. Now it would have to course correct for the culture to maintain, but that's where culture shifts. And now you've got these counterculture, or you've got other elements of culture that start to breed independently.
I mean, the interesting part,
that's how punk rock came about, right? Like it's like somebody deviates slightly. It's no longer part of the rock thing. Oh, now this is punk.
And then it propagates into the populace to become quote unquote normal. And interestingly, even if I see ads for smoking, it'll never motivate me to smoke. Why? Because people like me don't do something like that.
What does that mean? What does that statement in itself mean? People like me don't do something like that.
That's right. I mean, culture moves forward on the basis of social solidarity. Emil Durkheim has this beautiful phrase that he calls collective effervescence. Like, what an amazing phrase. Collective effervescence. And the idea is that people who subscribe to the same culture will act in concert in an effort to promote social solidarity, right? To stay in good standings with their people. So the phrase, do people like me do something like this? As we're asking ourselves, is this expected, acceptable conventions of my people? Because if I act out of step, people go, what are you doing, dude? What are you doing, right? Like, for instance,
It comes with judgment, right?
That's right. It becomes antisocial behavior that you get pushed out. And we as social animals, we don't want to be pushed out. So we act in accordance with people like ourselves. For instance, you know, like my people, my friends, like don't have very savory thoughts about Chick-fil-A. And if they ever saw me eating Chick-fil-A, they'll be like, dude, what are you doing? What are you doing, man? Because they don't believe in the company's morals and its beliefs and its ideologies. Therefore, my friends won't consume. Right. So if they see me do it, they go, Marcus, man, people like us don't do this. We don't do this kind of thing. And me breaking the social norms, the unwritten rules of people like myself, I risk being socially isolated.
Do better, Marcus. Do better.
I know. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, it's also about what we do in public. Also, the culture is dependent upon viewership.
Yes.
Just like it is, leadership is dependent upon followership and followership. And I do think that there's a internal culture that happens in private that is also that marketers are completely unaware of.
Yeah.
And have struggled to put their finger on that pulse.
Yeah.
And a really good marketer understands the insights of what's happening behind closed doors. That's right. Why the bedroom has always been a very difficult place for marketers to get to.
Yeah. The more conspicuous the consumption, the more in line our behaviors have to be with the people like us. When it's the more visible it is, the more important that there is congruence. But what happens when we find out about someone who were doing things that were antithetical to the culture, we go, I never knew him. I never knew her. I never knew that part about her. I never knew that part about him. And we're all like aghast. Like, how could this person do this? Because people like us don't do things like this.
And I was trying to make it through this podcast without using the word cancel, but I feel like this is a perfect segue, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is...
Is this part of what cancel culture is about? This idea that this is incongruent with what I need, and now I have to reject it with the same vehement emotion that I'm feeling from the incongruence of this original idea.
That's right. And we've always canceled people. Like, cancel culture always existed. The only difference now is that there are more receipts for us to go back to, even go back in time and be like, nah, man, remember this thing? Nah, fam. And like, it's not really cancel culture. It's more about accountabilities, hold people accountable. But the idea is that the behaviors of someone is out of sync with what we deem to be acceptable. And therefore, you're not invited to the barbecue, fam. You got to go. You're not one of us. And this is what we have always done, right? Lance Armstrong. Remember, everybody used to love Lance Armstrong? Back in the early 2000s, we all had like the Live Strong bracelets. So we realized Lance Armstrong is a dirtbag. And we go, no, thank you. I'm not doing that anymore, right? Our consumption was driven by what people like us do, right? Not because of functional reasons, but because of social and emotional reasons. And so cancel culture is really just a way by which we demarcate people like us.
Yeah, but I think the problem is if we go back to like motivations, people are so motivated to become almost celebrity status in any capacity, right? That's why influencers have seen such a surge. Like, we just want recognition. We want acknowledgement. We want notoriety from people. And I think that's why you see on social media specifically, you'll see people buying fake followers. Like, there are these actions. And the interesting part is you said it at the beginning, a crowd draws a crowd, right? So it's that same idea. We're accepting that people are buying fake followers where a crowd draws a crowd. At what point do we decide what is positive versus negative behavior? How do we decide when somebody gets canceled versus not canceled? It just feels a little convoluted right now, you know?
Well, it's like Elizabethan England, right? That people buy followers, they consume to signal where they are in a social hierarchy. Not because it adds value, functional value, because it adds psychological and sociological value, signal where I am. And here's the thing, that if all of your friends think that influencers are stupid, you don't talk to those friends about being an influencer. You go find other friends who are also influencers or believe in the power of influencers. We go find people who are like us. It's a psychological phenomenon called homophily, like self-loving. We like people who are like us. So we find people who are like us, who see the world the way we do. And as a result, we behave accordingly. And these things are governing our behavior. These things are driving what we are motivated to do. So when does it stop? It stops when we collectively say, we've had enough. And that seems like kind of like oversimplistic. But think about this. We've known R. Kelly was a monster for decades. It's been empirically evidenced that R. Kelly was a monster for decades. But it took a documentary for us to go, we're done. Now, we'll look at that documentary, Surviving R. Kelly, and say, that's why we did it. But that's not true. We all watched that documentary side by side through social networking platforms. And I heard Dahlia say, I think I'm done with this guy. Then Pablo said, yeah, I'm definitely done with this guy. And I go, oh, I guess I'm done with him too. Because if I listen to R. Kelly and Dahlia and Pablo don't, and they hear it come on, they go like, Marcus, what are you doing? Just like the chick.
I don't know about this. Marcus, we're going to need a second off episode, brother, because I got to tell you, you open up a can of worms here, and we're going to need a second episode for this podcast because we're right on the hour mark, and I cannot go into the how deeply I think that this conversation could go. So I want to invite you to come back again because I have a whole hypothesis on why the R. Kelly piece went the way it did. And I don't think it's because of the reasons that you've mentioned, but I think that's a time for another conversation.
And on that note, it should be in New York because we're all in New York.
That's what we'll do. We'll do it live next time. We'll do it live.
I've never been to Ann Arbor, though. I'd love to go to Ann Arbor one day. So maybe we take a field trip to Ann Arbor.
I like that.
Check that out. We like to normally close out with some words of wisdom. And we kind of have joked about this informal book club that we've started. So obviously, we're going to recommend your book to everybody. So that's at the top of the list. But is there something that you've read along the way that has inspired you or that you would recommend to others? And then maybe if you could leave us with some words of wisdom, something that's inspired you from a motivational perspective.
Yeah. A book I recommend is Dan Ariely's Predictably Irrational. It's the first book that I read that rang a bell that I couldn't unring. And it really was the start, the catalyst for my journey into academia. It made me see the world in a way I never saw before. And I can never go back to it, never go back to like seeing the world where I was before. So I credit Dan Ariely to that. And I love him dearly because of that. Advice I would give that motivated me. It's a quote from Steve Jobs back in the 90s. He says, if you look at everything around you is man-made. It was made by someone no smarter than you. So what's keeping you from making a dent in the world? And that has always been a battery on my back. They're like, yo, if an average Joe Schmo can do this, why can't I?
I love that. That's really, it's powerful because it's true, right? If the average person can do this, so can I. I can make a difference too. It's funny because that goes back to the entrepreneurial mindset.
That's right.
You have to be willing to be an entrepreneur and break some rules in order to really connect with that audience. So find people.
Absolutely. And that helps you persevere and stay motivated when times get hard, for sure.
Yeah.
You've been so generous with your time, Marcus. We really appreciate it. We wish you so much continued success with the book. I know it's received great acclaim since it came out in May. And so for all of our listeners, we hope you go out and grab a copy. And I was kind of joking, but I think I'm kind of serious that I really would love to have you come back on at some stage for episode 2. And we'll jump it off with some R. Kelly and then take it where it goes from there.
Awesome. Marcus, how long are you in New York until?
I'm leaving tomorrow morning on the 7 a.m. flight back home.
When are you back?
I'm back in 2 weeks, I think, but I'm with the family. And then the week after that, I'm back.
Well, separately, I think I'm hungering for like an actual marketing conversation. So if you're up for meeting IRL for a marketing conversation, I know Pablo is really in for that because I think it's always hard for us to not focus this conversation towards marketing. So
Pablo, you jump in the Volvo and come on down to the city.
Hey, I'm a lot cooler than I made myself sound.
I'm talking. Yo, you used to run a nightclub. Like that, you get a lot of cred.
So yeah, so if you're open to it, I'd love to shoot over some dates and let's definitely get something on the calendar.
And thank then you all so very much. This was great.
This was really amazing. And separately, I know that Pablo had mentioned circling back for another podcast. We have an opportunity to podcast live at Samsung. So if that's interesting to you, we could get that scheduled.
Oh yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, I thought that would be kind of cool. Culture, cool, right?
All right, friends. Thank you so much. Talk to you really soon.
Thanks, Marcus, for joining us. And thanks for joining us on the Motivated Podcast.